Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're on a presidential history roll here. During our program last week, it was John Quincy Adams, and today it is Dwight Eisenhower. Our guest is the author of a splendid book. It's titled 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission, but the book covers so much more than 3 Days in January. It's a really thorough examination of Dwight Eisenhower's life, his early life, and how he became who he was. The Allied commander of D-Day, that's enough in a lifetime to say, hey, I've done something with my life, but he did much more than that. And it's becoming appreciated again, and will be even more appreciated after the publication, which I believe is today, the official publication of Brett Baer's book, 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. And he is our guest this hour, Brett Baer. Many of you will know who he is. He serves as Fox News Channel's chief political anchor and anchor of Special Report with Brett Baer. It's on weeknights. It is the top-rated cable news program in its time slot and one of the top 5 shows in cable news. He has been all over the world. He has hosted and moderated presidential debates. He also has been reporting from Iraq some 12 times, Afghanistan 13 times, traveled the world with various administrations and military officials and reported from 74 countries. He also is author of the New York Times bestseller, Special Heart, A Journey of Faith, Hope, Courage, and Love. And this hour, it's Dwight Eisenhower we talk about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Brett, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for writing about him. I just wanted to know more about Dwight Eisenhower, and when you look at the expanse of his life, the incredibly humble beginnings, this is the guy who was in charge of D-Day, for heaven's sake. I can't imagine being in that position. We don't think enough about him or his presidency. He's been kind of overlooked, and you overlooked him until you went golfing, right?
That's exactly right, and that's where I really discovered that I didn't know much about President Eisenhower. I knew about General Eisenhower, and as a guy who covers politics and covers Washington, I found that troubling. I went to Augusta National, which I'm a golfer. I played in college, and I got the holy grail of golf invites down to Augusta, where they play the Masters, and they told me when I got there that I was staying in the Eisenhower cabin, and I was on cloud 9 coming out of my shoes, and I couldn't sleep that night, so I poured myself a glass of wine, and I walked around. And if you have ever seen it, it's not really a cabin. I mean, it's like a little white house on the 10th tee of Augusta, and it overlooks the par 3 course. It's an idyllic setting. So late that night, I walked around the house and the Secret Service quarters in the basement, and all of the decor is still in the 50s kind of as Eisenhower had it. And the things on the wall and the writings and the sculptures, and I thought, I need to know about this presidency. So after that round, I vowed soon thereafter to go out to Abilene, Kansas, to the Eisenhower Library. And if you've never been, it is.
I have not been there. I've been to Gettysburg, but I haven't been to the library.
It's worth the trip. Yeah. His boyhood home, the actual place, is right there. He's buried there, and they have a wonderful museum that goes over his life. And when I talked to the folks there, I said, I know there have been a lot of books on Eisenhower, but what could I breathe life into? You know, to introduce, if I didn't know, surely my generation and younger didn't know. It seemed like history started with Kennedy for a lot of us.
Yes.
And they said this transition from Eisenhower to Kennedy, and specifically the farewell address, which, by the way, was delivered 56 years ago tonight.
Tonight, I know. I thought about that as I was getting ready for the show. I thought, oh, my goodness, it was tonight it happened.
Yeah. So they said, come with me. And they took me back to the library portion, and the amazing people who work there, they bring out this gray cardboard box, and they tell me to put on these white gloves, I'm sitting at this giant wooden table, and slowly they pull out of the gray cardboard box this plastic folder, and inside the plastic folder they hand me three sheets of paper, and it is the address that he delivered 56 years ago tonight with his scribbles and pencil and underlines and capitalizing Eisenhower's, you know, address, farewell address, that is so well known for the military-industrial complex line. Mm-hmm. And I held it and I thought, this is it. You know, this is the thing that will enable me to jump back and look at his life and his presidency.
Mm. Well, let's go back to Abilene, Kansas for a moment, because here is a man who's brought up, and I want you to talk more about the religious upbringing. He grows up in a family, evidently, that is adhering to a faith where people are conscientious objectors.
Right.
And here he becomes the Supreme Allied Commander, for heaven's sake. How did that happen from his upbringing?
That's a great question. That's right. His family is River Brethren, offshoot of the Mennonites, and they eventually become Protestant later on, but it's a very religious family. His mom, she wins a contest when she's growing up, memorizing thousands of Bible verses. So religion and faith is a big part of who he is growing up. He almost dies. He almost loses a leg. In a he hurts his leg, and they almost have to amputate it. He says they pray over it. They decide, you know what, they're going to fight through, and he does. He leaves childhood, goes to West Point, and because he thought that that would be the best education, and his family supports him despite the fact that they were conscientious objectors. Here is a guy who really was the most famous, most successful warrior, general, a man of war who craved peace. That was his biggest thing as president, and it comes out in this farewell address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure does. To give the well, let's talk about the years in the Army. You write about he was probably hoping to go into service in World War I to be in combat, but it takes 25 years in the Army before he finally is in a war, and all of a sudden he's giving, you know, the head of Operation Overlord and is giving the order of D-Day. Can you talk about this on many fronts, how
yeah.
Mamie Eisenhower, who had followed him from place to place to place, a life in the Army, what her thoughts were, and what his thoughts were after all these years of preparation to be at the head of this extraordinary battle?
Yeah, you know, he wanted to be a fighter, and but he was always tapped as a strategic thinker and writer. In fact, a lot of people don't know that as colonel, he was the speechwriter for Douglas MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur. He is realized throughout West Point and his early time in the Army as someone who can deal with all of the egos. And when he finally gets to general, he exhibits that as he's going up the chain, and he catches the eye of President Roosevelt, who determines that he is going to lead because he can deal with the egos of Patton and MacArthur and Bradley, and then when he's dealing with the allies of Montgomery and De Gaulle. And they give him an African operation first that goes well, and then he goes to D-Day. The inside stories about his time as general overseeing D-Day are really quite something. And, you know, I should note, Kathleen, that I'm not an historian. I'm a reporter. I stand on the shoulders of historians who so I'm writing this as a reporter.
Right.
And I report, you decide.
Mm-hmm.
It's catchy. Mm-hmm. So we find these little tidbits. One of them, the night before D-Day, we found this letter that he writes, and he says, if this operation fails, it fails because of me.
Yes.
And no one else.
Right.
He accidentally dates it July 5th, not June 5th, and he sticks it in his pocket. And it doesn't fail. They go through all of the different problems with the operation. They almost move it because of the weather, But, you know, that was the turning point, and that changed world history.
You write about how he found Douglas MacArthur to be arrogant, unwilling to face facts. It's interesting, when I think of Eisenhower, I think of a man, he must have had some amount of ego or he couldn't have risen to where he did, but nothing that was really visible. You never think of him as being an arrogant man, do you?
No. He was a humble leader, and that is a rare quality. He credited his family. Great story about, you know, coming home after the war, and he does a ticker tape parade in New York and bounces around cities, and they, you know, parades everywhere, and finally has a parade in Abilene, Kansas, and the streets are packed. He's in the back of a car waving as he's driving down, and someone turns to his mother, Ida Eisenhower, and says, "You must be so proud of your son." And she says, "Which one?" He had six sons, and he points to that story as evidence of how a humble upbringing helped him later in life. I think you're right. His leadership style was to empower others, to let them take credit, but to have a steady hand on the till, like a cautious balance. But he was also a doer. He was not ideological. He was more practical. And that exhibits itself later as he works with Democrats and gets a number of big things across the finish line legislatively.
Who persuaded him? Because I can't imagine he thought deeply about, oh, well, someday I'm going to become president of the country. Who nudged him in that direction?
Well, first, when he comes back, President Truman realizes his overwhelming popularity and automatically reaches out to him and says, in fact, that he's going to step aside and he'll run as vice president if Eisenhower is president as a Democrat. And Eisenhower just doesn't think that that's what he wants. He really hates politics and talks about that extensively. He doesn't like the phoniness of it, he says. And so he says, he politely declines, says no. He goes to Columbia University, become president of Columbia, and he is bombarded by Republicans, very many, long string, and some of them are his close friends. He finally is persuaded to run in that 1952 race, and that really angers Truman to the point where he starts saying things publicly to reporters, saying Eisenhower he doesn't know anything about government, he's no good, he knows as much about governing as a pig knows about Sunday.
Ooh.
And Eisenhower, you know, then reciprocates and doesn't say anything, but it steams him, it makes him mad, to the point where he wins that election on Inauguration Day. Excuse me. Eisenhower and Mamie drive up to the White House, and the tradition is for the incoming president and his wife to go into the White House and have coffee and then make the drive to from the White House to the Capitol.
Right.
They drive up, and because the relationship is so chilly by then, the Eisenhowers stay in the car. The Trumans stay in the White House, and there's a standoff there on the portico. And finally, the Trumans come down, they get in the car, and both the Truman Library and the Eisenhower Library describe that ride from the White House to the Capitol as silent. Not one word.
Goodness.
And so imagine being the driver of that car, you know.
Exactly.
How you doing back there?
Yeah, right. Trying to make small talk.
Yeah.
And he gets criticized. Tell me what the truth is here about not inviting Harry Truman to the White House after Ike has been inaugurated during his 8 years. Did he invite Truman and Truman just said no?
Well, so this is where the libraries diverge.
Ah.
The Eisenhowers and the oral histories at the Eisenhower Library say he clearly invited him many times, but the Trumans declined. The Truman Library says he didn't invite him or didn't personally invite him and therefore didn't come. So the relationship was really rocky. In fact, after he's sworn in, Eisenhower in 1953, he offers to fly the Trumans home. And the Trumans say, no, thank you, and they go to Union Station, and they get on a train by themselves and go back to Missouri. So it's not until after the assassination of President Kennedy that the former president, two former presidents get together at the Blair House and have lunch and kind of mend ways a little bit.
Hmm. Brett, tell me about his going to Korea, being so moved. When did he go? It was right before the inauguration, right? He was so moved by what he saw that it affected him deeply, and I'm wondering about that trip.
Yeah, he went to Korea as president-elect, and it was about a month after the election. He decided that I shall go to Korea is what he announced, that if he won the presidency, and he thought he could broker some peace in the Korean conflict that had essentially stalemated under Truman. So after he wins, a month later, he goes as president-elect, and that really outraged Truman. So that made the relationship even worse, saying that, you know, as president-elect, he has none of the authority as president. And it was a break, clearly, with protocol. And you know, when I first covered the incident of the Taiwanese president calling President-elect Trump, and he takes the call, and the dust up here in Washington about breaking protocol and what that meant for China, and I immediately thought, gosh, I mean, Eisenhower broke protocol too. Back in that day, different time, different experience. But I was intrigued by that as a president-elect stepping into foreign policy.
Yeah, it's always important, and I think we're missing that in this country so much, to have history inform what we think about the present. I mean, there's so much. It's so good you delved into Dwight Eisenhower because it will affect how you see a lot of other things now.
Kathleen, I totally agree, and I think that, you know, that's really the essence of why I wrote the book. And the dedication to the book is to our sons. I write to our sons, Paul and Daniel, and their generation. Please allow history to inform your decisions in the future. And I think, and you know, the book starts with President-elect Kennedy meeting President Eisenhower in the Oval Office, and it ends with President-elect Trump meeting President Obama in the Oval Office. And I think there's a lot to learn here in that transition that potentially weighs in this year.
Mm. Yeah, my book is, I don't have the whole book yet. I don't have that last part yet.
Oh, gotcha. We got to get you one ASAP.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to read 2017, the last word. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have much more to talk about. Dwight Eisenhower will talk about the farewell address, which was delivered in 1961 on this very day. We'll talk about the meetings that he had with JFK and what the two of them thought of each other, what he was told. We'll talk about Vietnam. We'll talk about the thought that went into the farewell address and some of the memorable, very memorable lines that came from it. Our phone number, love to have you join the conversation as well. I don't know if many of you have had a chance to read the book because it's really just been released. It's Brett Baer's book, 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. But it's also about the life of Dwight Eisenhower, which is also well worth reading. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your messages there. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Joining us this hour to talk about Dwight Eisenhower is Brett Baer. The book is 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. We have a lot of calls coming in, so let's start with Daryl in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hi.
Hi.
I have 2 points I'd like to point out, please.
All right.
One is Eisenhower allowed the CIA and Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of a former U.S. President Roosevelt, to undermine the democratically elected president of Iran, which brought about a coup against President Mossadegh. The second point is Eisenhower, in his final speech, where he named what I would call the cowboy way the American way, when he made reference to what is now known as the military-industrial complex, which he actually called the military-industrial congressional complex.
Scientific complex, really.
Pardon me?
Congressional.
Okay.
He was actually asked by someone to remove that word congressional from the definition, which he did.
Hmm.
That's true.
Hmm.
That is very true. As far as the covert operations, there's a lot of covert operations that happened under Eisenhower that we just are finding out about or and have found out about in recent years. He is accurate about the congressional complex. He wanted to call it the military-industrial-scientific congressional complex. His speechwriters and advisors said, one, that was too complex, or he didn't want to have the point be pointed at Congress when he was trying to also make the message in that same speech about bipartisanship and getting things across the finish line and concern about the deficit and the debt. But to his point, the concern he had was that the industries had created their own money circle after making equipment for World War II had turned into this operation where they would funnel money through lobbyists to lawmakers. Lawmakers would then influence policy, and some of the people in government would then leave their jobs and go to run or be on the boards of these companies, and thereby the circle would would continue and be self-fulfilling. He had a real worry about that and believed that the dissenting views and a president needed to have the ability to operate outside of that pressure. And the thing that made him most mad is when he saw ads for missiles from different defense contractors popping up in magazines like Life. And
goodness,
he said, you know, this is it. And in one bipartisan meeting at the White House, he slams his hand down on the cabinet table and he says, expletive, how many times do we have to kill a man? Saying that we had plenty of nuclear weapons at the time. And remember, the specter of nuclear war was always on his shoulder as the Cold War got colder.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Cold War for a moment, because there was, as many people alive during that time will remember, this race, you know, to be first in space, this race to have more nuclear arms. You talk a lot and write about a lot in the book about JFK's campaign, really centering on the fact that the Russians were ahead of us, you know, that we had to catch up here, when in reality, this missile gap was not extensive at all. As a matter of fact, it was non-existent, and Eisenhower knew that. Did he talk to Kennedy about that, and why did Kennedy use that as a big part of his campaign?
He did. He talked to him about that. In fact, Eisenhower sent messages to candidate Kennedy, the senator, to make sure he knew that that was not accurate, what he was saying, that even though Khrushchev in Moscow was saying that they were churning out missiles like sausages, that that wasn't accurate, number one. Number two, that the U.S. had many more, so this U.S. missile gap was not real. Kennedy portrayed it as weakness, and that the U.S. was essentially weak in the face of a growling bear from the Soviet Union. And that made Eisenhower very mad and skeptical of Kennedy. When he meets Kennedy in that first meeting, he does talk about that, but he realizes that Kennedy was using the politics of the moment to get elected. By the way, let me rewind to the election of 1960. Nixon keeps Eisenhower off the trail. And there's Nixon people say that it was because of his health. Eisenhower people say because he just didn't want him out there and he wanted to be his own man, and they had some friction. But he finally goes out in the last 2 weeks, Eisenhower does, to campaign for Nixon. And he sees, he goes around the country and he's sees signs that say, I like Ike, but I'm voting for Jack. And Kennedy people get really worried. In fact, Kennedy is quoted as saying, every day that Eisenhower is on the trail, I feel like I'm standing on a pile of sand and a wave is coming in and I sink lower and lower. And the Kennedy people believe that had Eisenhower had another week or two on the trail, that they may have lost that election to Nixon.
Oh, that's fascinating. So why was it, considering what he said, his concerns about the military, his concern about wanting peace because he had seen the horrors, he really had seen the horrors of war. When we look at the number of warheads, you cite in the book that it went from 1,000 nuclear warheads at the beginning of his presidency to 23,000. Was he concerned about disarmament? Did he try to do something in relation to disarmament? And why did the number of warheads heads go up so significantly?
Well, in part that was this race against the Soviets. In part, it was self-fulfilling in what he was concerned about in military-industrial complex. And Congress had bought on to this, that this was something, it was an imperative. And it was, the other word he was going to put in there was scientific, because some of these companies had gotten into the scientific community and had kind of bought in. They had bought in to the idea that to be as strong as the U.S. could be, they needed more of these weapons. Eisenhower believed that they had a strong enough army and enough missiles with what they had, and he believed that America's success, that it wasn't the size of the dog in the fight, it was the size of the fight in the dog, and that they had plenty to be able to defend themselves. But it was a perception thing, and Eisenhower was very, very concerned about it.
Thank you, Daryl, very much for your call. Jerry in West Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon. It's going to sound like echoing what you said, Kathleen. You made a comment a couple minutes before the caller, and I was thinking the same thought about 5 minutes or so before you said it out loud, pretty much. So it makes me feel like maybe I'm not so dumb. And secondly, all I wanted to say was I took interest in your guest's comment that he said he was a reporter and not a historian. And I would just want to encourage him. First of all, I can't wait to get this book. But secondly, I wanted to encourage him as he meets younger reporters maybe coming up here throughout the rest of his career that he could possibly point them to do the same thing, is try and dig up some history of our country of people like this or events that have happened and maybe really get the information out there to us out here so we can make more informed decisions. I know don't get very much from newspapers anymore, and I really don't want to rely on just the internet or just television news even. So if we can get information like this in paper and really dissect it and digest it, maybe it'll help us be better in the electorate out here in the nation. And thank you for an outstanding program today.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks so much for the call. How true. We need to learn our history. I love reading about presidents. You probably do too, Brett.
Yeah.
But it frames history for me to know, well, here was the leader. Here's what happened during that time period. But I fear that we're woefully ignorant, many of us.
We are. And, you know, listen, I can't defend my business fully because we deal in 30-second sound bites, and we deal in fast-moving stories.
Right.
And in 24-hour news, it's a different thing, which is why I was honored to do this hour special that we aired on Fox just this past weekend called 3 Days in January, and it tracked the book. And we spent a lot of time interviewing people who were a part of this administration or historians.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And it's going to be online.
Good.
Very soon, and I think it'll have another run, and I'm sure it'll come out. But I think that it is important that we expand a little bit more and go deeper into some of these things, because it's cliche to say, but we can learn from the past. It is very cyclical. I think this book is very relevant to today, and that speech is very relevant to today, and could actually have been delivered as a farewell speech by President Obama, breathing life into history. We found these oral histories that had never been tapped, and these documents and these letters that had never been released from the Truman Library and the Eisenhower Library and the Kennedy Library. And, you know, it was a decisive time. We're, again, in a troubled world. If you replace communism with terrorism and the threat of war is still ever present, there's many lessons to convey to us today about how to keep America safe.
Well, we spent the first hour of this show talking about Russia, so let's talk about Russia for a moment. Let's talk about the Soviet Union. I found the visit of the passages about Khrushchev are fascinating to me, and the visit that Khrushchev made, because I've been to that very humble farm in Gettysburg.
Yeah.
I just love that place. It just seems so Eisenhower in so many ways.
Yeah.
But Khrushchev's visit to the grandchildren at that farm. And if there was anything to be learned about Khrushchev and Putin is. Is there anything that you bring from Khrushchev to Putin? And
well,
tell us
I think they're actually very
meeting.
Similar in a historical sense. I mean, think about it. There have been now two administrations in a row who have tried to reset relations. One with Secretary Clinton and the Obama administration literally trying to reset with a reset button. But George W. Bush said he looked into the eyes of Vladimir Putin and saw his soul. And there's been this need, this want to create this relationship. And now it seems that President Trump will try to do the same thing. What Eisenhower learned was that Khrushchev was a great politician. He had his own hidden hand. And that he was very personable and could interact with the grandchildren at the Gettysburg Farm. And he watched Westerns with Eisenhower at Camp David, which, by the way, was named for Eisenhower's grandchild, mm-hmm. David. And, you know, he was very affable, and they talked and toured around cities in the U.S. And at that point, Eisenhower felt that he was making progress to thaw the Cold War and thought it very possible. Everything changed when the Soviets shot down the U-2 spy plane over a site in outside Moscow, and everything pretty much turned around. And Eisenhower regretted in that final speech that he never got to the place where he could say, "We're in a peaceful spot," as he hands the baton off to President Kennedy.
Hmm. Well, let's move to, we'll go back to Eisenhower and his time as president, but let's move to the farewell address. Was he thinking about George Washington when he thought about this farewell address?
He was. He loved Washington. There was a direct, obviously, correlation as a military man who was recruited to politics reluctantly. And he saw Washington's farewell, the first farewell, as the perfect example of what America was, that the office of the president was bigger than any one man, that it wasn't about a campaign or a candidate, it was about the office. So as he structured the speech, he had that in mind, and you'll notice that in the speech itself, it does not list his accomplishments. It's not like a shopping list of what he got done in 8 years. It is more a blueprint and a warning and an optimism for the future.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the meetings he had with JFK before he gave this address and what their relationship was. What did he wish, what did he worry about with the incoming president, and what wisdom did he wish to give to him?
So he was skeptical about Kennedy. He thought on the campaign trail as he watched him that he thought he was hollow and kind of a matinee idol, and was getting a lot of press because of his good looks and demeanor, and reporters loved him. So Eisenhower didn't think he had a lot of experience and was fearful that he was going to be a dismal leader. He met him in the Oval Office, as I mentioned, and had a meeting for a long time, longer, much longer than they expected. And both the Kennedy Library and the Eisenhower Library describe in oral histories, various, that the meeting went very well, and that Eisenhower was very impressed with the man, and he felt like maybe the American people saw something that he didn't on the campaign trail. But he still had the feeling, the worry, that Kennedy was a little cocky when it came to disregarding national security bureaucracy. In other words, the apparatus that Eisenhower had taken pains to set up with the National Security Council and a debate of a dissenting views on various operations before making a decision. And in fact, Kennedy did dismantle a lot of that and relied on just a few advisors and his own counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Then he, you know, gets in office, and the Bay of Pigs happens,
right,
with Cuba. And the first person he calls is Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
And he flies Eisenhower to Camp David, and that's the iconic image on the front of the book, where they're walking up the path And both libraries have the quotes that say Kennedy turns to Eisenhower and says, you know, you just don't know how tough this job is until you're in it. And Eisenhower turns to Kennedy with a smile and says, with all due respect, Mr. President, I think I told you this 3 months ago.
Yeah, I would imagine. I can't imagine what that office must be like. It just, oh, my gosh. You think you got deadlines, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You work every day.
Exactly.
Nothing compared to these people. In part of the speech, he talks about, and this is something that's been of worry to so many generations. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the drills that took place in the 60s under the desk and the worry, the incredible worry and legitimate worry. And I think you said that Eisenhower's grandson David worried about this, too, of a Russian menace, as we thought about in those days. But Eisenhower talks during this farewell address about disarmament. It's a continuing imperative, he writes. We must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. The need is sharp and apparent. And he says that he has a definite sense of disappointment as he leaves the office that he wasn't able to accomplish a whole lot on that front. How much do you worry, and do other presidents worry about this very issue, and why has it been so hard to put down those arms?
Well, I think it's a great question, and why this is so relevant today. You know, Eisenhower delivers a speech at the United Nations where he comes up with this program, Atoms for Peace, and that sets up what is now the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. It's a different threat now. We have long since stopped fearing, because of mutual assured destruction, the threat that somebody is just going to willy-nilly fire a nuclear weapon. And remember, during Eisenhower's time, there were all these studies, and everybody was building a bomb shelter. And
right.
That was where the head was on if you lived in any place in America. Now it's a different threat. Now, really, the proliferation of nuclear weapons or nuclear material in the hands of terrorists who have no problem or compunction for firing off or blowing up even the smallest of nuclear or even dirty bomb that has nuclear material in it, that is the threat. And I think President Obama tried to deal with that early on in his term with former Senator Dick Lugar and others. But it's a tough thing to get across the finish line. Disarmament, for some reason, the countries feel like it's a security blanket to have all of these missiles. Well, Eisenhower would say you can destroy the world many times over with all the missiles that we have.
Right. Let's go to Kevin in Green Bay. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Joy.
It's Kathleen, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
The guest said that he wrote the book as a reporter and not as a historian, referencing the Fox News slogan that he reports, we decide. To me, that sounds like the information may not be put in the proper historical context, but I was wondering how he would see how he sees the book that he wrote would be different if a historian wrote it.
Okay. I said I'm a reporter, and I am. I stand on the shoulders of historians. I don't presume to make a determination of what's right and what's wrong about history. I'm reporting what we found. These are oral histories. They are documents. They are letters. And it is a narrative. I am humble in my, estimation of my abilities to, accurately portray a time, but I think we've done it, and I will, if you'll permit me, read from some historians.
Of course.
Jay Winnick, historian, New York Times bestselling author, 1944, April 1865. Magnificently rendered, Bret Baier's 3 days in January is destined to take its place as not only one of the masterworks on Ike, but as one of the classics of presidential history. This is a too little known but remarkable story filled with drama, power, and enduring lessons for leadership today. Impeccably researched, the book is nothing short of extraordinary. What a triumph. Michael Beschloss, a presidential historian, As general and president, Dwight Eisenhower was one of the greatest leaders in American history, and Brett Baer's book is a welcome and valuable contribution to our appreciation of Ike, describing some of his most important qualities of character, wisdom, and leadership, which are so needed in public figures of our own era. And just two more. Douglas Brinkley, historian and author of Cronkite, Brett Baer's 3 Days in January brilliantly illuminates the genius and intrigue behind Eisenhower's historic farewell address. Written with verve and deeply researched, Baer ably dissects fact from myth, a landmark achievement in U.S. presidential history. Finally, Tom Brokaw, NBC anchor and author, Brett Baer has given history a great gift, a riveting account of Dwight Eisenhower's determination to call on his vast experience to prepare America for the perils of the new war, the Cold War. So, again, I'm humbled by those comments, and I was just saying I'm a reporter. I guess I'm an aspiring historian, and they think we did something right.
Yeah. Well, it reads like a history. I've read a lot of presidential biographies in my time, and it's a history of Eisenhower. I mean, let's face it, there's not a political angle to this. You've obviously researched his life pretty thoroughly, and that's how it reads. And that's how it reads well. My only problem is the title of this, because the book is just as much about Eisenhower's whole life as it is 3 Days in January, don't you think, Brett?
Yeah, I do. And this was the impetus for the start, you know,
to
look through the soda straw of these 3 days and the narrative to then bounce back and give context and perspective to his life and how he gets to this moment. He worked for almost 2 years on that farewell address.
Incredible.
21 drafts of the speech. And I think it shows that he put his experience as a general and as a president into those works.
Yeah, obvious question is why he worked so hard on it. What did he want people to remember? Many years later or the next week, we'll talk about that with him. We also wanted to hear just a little bit of Eisenhower because his voice has been, well, we haven't heard very much of his voice since he died. And as Brett was telling us, it was 56 years ago today that Eisenhower gave his farewell address. So let's go back in time for a moment. Near the end, the president was warning of not plundering the resources of our nation and planet for our grandchildren. Here is Ike.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony of disarmament of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
From Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address delivered on this very day during the evening in 1961. We're speaking this hour with the author of 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. Brett Baer is here. He is the chief political anchor for Fox News Channel and the anchor and executive editor of Special Report with Brett Baer, seen 5 days a week on the Fox News Channel. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Before we heard a portion of his farewell address, Brett, you talked about the number of years that Eisenhower had worked on this speech. Why? That's an incredibly long period of time.
He felt that his dismount, if you will, his final message should be a compilation of what he had learned in the military and what he had learned as president about the nation and the way forward. He felt, and that is the essence of the final mission. His final mission was to send a message not only to his successor, who he had concerns about, as I mentioned before, but also to make to have a message to the American people that while it was a happy days time, and you remember the show Happy Days, it was set in that time in the 50s, and it was a sleepy time, and it was a time that people, you know, didn't focus too much on the threats and the problems. It was a happy time, and he had warnings of, yes, but there's a reason why it was happy. It's because we worked behind the scenes. We worked to stay out of conflicts wherever we could avoid them. We worked diplomatically. And he had warnings about, you know, the industry that was essentially churning up the need and want to get more involved.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jim in Boston. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen and Brett. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Jim?
I've got a golf question, but growing up in back in Iowa, back in the mid-50s, my neighbor girl across the street, my classmate, mentioned that she was the cousin to Ike, I guess. But
oh, really?
I could never prove that or not. But the golf question is, and I think it was at the Masters course, the Eisenhower tree.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
That's in the book.
I don't know if he couldn't get his drive around it or
yes.
a post shot or whatever, but I know they saved the tree, but perhaps you could
sure.
go into that story a little bit.
Yeah, I can definitely illuminate on that. Thanks, Jim, for the call. As a golfer, I was really interested in that part of it, and it also drew me to Ike. You're right. He played Augusta National, and on 17, there was a big tree on the left side, and Eisenhower always had a hook, and he could never get it around the tree. It would always hit the tree, and he hated 17. And he begged with his good friend, the chairman of the club, to cut it down. And they said, no, you can't cut it down. Even though you're the president of the United States, we are not cutting down the tree. So just a couple of years ago in an ice storm in Georgia, the ice storm did what Eisenhower could not, and it destroyed the tree. They chopped it up. They made it a table in the wine area of the clubhouse, and they also gave a slice of it, of the trunk, to the Eisenhower Library in Abilene. You know, one quick story. Eisenhower loved golf and loved it so much because he believed that it took his mind, he could focus more when he was out on the course. You know, President Obama says something different, that it frees his mind a little bit. And Eisenhower would go outside the Rose Garden, and he would just swing a club. And he would come back in and be very angry. And Ann Whitman was his secretary, and she'd say, Mr. President, what's wrong? And he said, those blanking squirrels, they get in my backswing. I hate the squirrels. And it was a recurring problem. So one time he had the Secret Service gather up all the squirrels on the White House property and carefully take them to Rock Creek Park. And Ann Whitman tells the story. She said, Mr. President, they're going to be back, and they have every right to be there just like you.
Exactly. That's a great story. Let's go to – thank you, Jim, so much for your call. Annie in Watertown. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Listening to the farewell speech, Tom Hartman plays it often on his show. What stands out to me always was his speaking of love, and I just think that was just such a great thing. And, you know, this Republican military man speaking of love, and something we could incorporate into our political rhetoric or political conversations today.
Hmm. Totally agree with you, and so does Mary Jean Eisenhower, who I talked to. She's a grandchild, granddaughter. That is her favorite line as well.
Mm.
And it reads, to all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunities shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its few spiritual blessings. And he goes on to talk about love. He loved it so much that it is one of the quotes near his grave at the chapel at the library.
That's quite lovely. And I like what he had on his paperweight on his desk, gently in manner, strong indeed, which describes him to a T, doesn't it?
It does. And he was not somebody who was touting from the rooftops. I think if he was here today, he would probably say, get off Twitter. Don't tweet to the incoming president, if I had a bet. He would probably say less is more, and that words matter, especially from the Oval Office. So that was his style. His style was the hidden hand, and that was from Fred Goldstein, political scientist, who came up with that.
Thanks for the book. Thanks for the hour. It was great. Thanks, Brett.
I appreciate it.
Brett Baer, chief political anchor for Fox News Channel and the anchor and executive editor of Special Report with Brett Baer. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers, and thanks to Colleen Duvall for production and for on-air production. We'll hear just a few of Ike's words as we say goodbye for today.
Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity.